I said nothing more. But I carefully fastened the bonnet on my load and we proceeded. It had snowed in the forest some days before, white patches remained everywhere. Tired, we stopped at the entrance of a transversal valley from which descended a large torrent flowing toward the River New. After a search, Yongdan discovered a camping ground out of sight of the road. But the cold wind swept that leafless spot. We therefore found a second place, lower down and near the track. Until now our tent had been of little use to us as a tent. Since our departure, we had pitched it only once. But it was precious as a blanket. We used to lie down, in Tibetan fashion, with our luggage between us, so that nothing could be taken without awakening us. We both had our revolvers at hand. Our inner belts, containing silver and gold, were often hidden near us between stones or buried under dry leaves, or, if the country seemed safe, we placed them next us. The tent was then spread over the luggage and ourselves as well. When snow had fallen, that white tent spread on the ground, with a few dry leaves and twigs strewn on it, looked absolutely like a patch of snow amongst other patches, and we felt quite safe under it. So we slept that night under our favorite imitation of a patch of snow laid near the road. We were really overconfident about the illusion that we created. The trick was no doubt excellent, still, it could not work if we were under the very feet of the passers-by. Before daybreak, some traders passed, and one of them noticed something strange about our snow patch. "Tis that men or snow?" he asked one of his companions. "Snow," answered the fellow, who probably had not even looked our way, but saw snow all over the wood. The first who had spoken uttered a sound denoting doubt. We were laughing silently under our tent, but as the man could have thrown a stone at us to ascertain our living or inanimate nature, a Yongdan in a deep, sepulchral voice affirmed, "It is snow." The loaded mules of the caravan started at the noise and the men laughed heartily. The Lama then emerged from the cloth, leaving me under it, and chatted a few minutes with the traders, who were going to Atuns in Chinese Tibet. "Are you alone?" they asked Yongdan. "Yes," he answered. And they went their way. That morning we passed a village and reached a small tableland from which we discovered, far three front of us, a steep hill on which could be seen a thread-like path that could be none other than that over the Tala, which we were to cross. Those who wished to avoid the tiring climb and a second pass, the Kula, farther off, could follow a narrow path along the river. Arjapas, we were told, went that way. But I had heard that some parts of this path were exceedingly difficult, and that one had to cling to the rocks, walk on all fours, and generally perform a series of feats which I did not feel tempted to undertake with a heavy load on my back. Better for us to follow the tiring but safer road. I did not yet know that the days would come when I could not avoid playing the equilibrist on rocks overlooking precipices. I lacked another and much more useful piece of information. When looking at the hill and the perpendicular, narrow yellow ribbon which crossed it, I thought only of the fatigue of the climbing, and did not suspect that the whole success of my journey would be in jeopardy before our ascent began. I did not know, and so walked gaily down to the bottom of the valley. We found a pleasant place next to a stream, and feeling somewhat lazy, rested there for the remainder of the afternoon and the night. We were even imprudent enough to pitch our tent to make ourselves more comfortable, although we knew that a village was near us, beyond the stream. Next morning, contrary to our custom, we did not make haste to start. A man came and talked a long time with Yongdan, who invited him to drink a bowl of soup. And then we learned that we were loitering just in front of a Lhasa official's house. We could only curse our folly. But what was done could not be undone. The man who had spoken with my young friend was a soldier, a retainer of the official. Thus, if any suspicion had arisen in his mind, and he reported it to his chief, we could not escape our fate. I suppose that, when we left the place to proceed through the dreaded village, there was something in our mien of people sentenced to death and walking toward the scaffold. On and on we went. The track skirted the fields and led rather far from the houses. We reached a courtyard, around which I walked thrice with an edifying countenance, touching it with my forehead. Higher and higher we were going. The official's dwelling was now far behind us and nobody had stopped us. Nearby was the border of the wooded zone. Lajikdo, we would shout it loudly when reaching the summit above the village. What joy would then be ours? Once more we were to escape. Oi! Oi! A villager was running after us across the fields. You must come before the Ponpo, chief, he said. These were the very same words with which I had been stopped in Kaam, after my hard journey through the snows, and the crossing of the Iron Bridge. With perfect composure, Yongdan immediately mastered the situation. He put his lo down on the ground, in order to avoid the curiosity of the Ponpo and his servants, who, had they seen it, would most likely have wanted to look at its contents. He did not even give me a glance, as if the thought never occurred to him that an insignificant old woman like me could be worth the attention of a Kivdak nobleman. Let us go, he said to the man, and the two went off, chatting together. I humbly squatted on the path, near our baggage. Taking my Tibetan rosary from my neck, I made a pretense of telling the beads. The words I had heard took me back to my previous adventure. Very likely the end, now, would be the same. Once again, all the hardships endured would have been in vain. I saw ourselves escorted back to the nearest Chinese frontier, passing through the villages, a prey to the curiosity of the country folk. Not for 1 minute did I consider the idea of giving up the game. I had sworn that a woman should pass, and I would. But when, and how, if it was not today? Some time elapsed. Presently I heard a voice. The sound grew louder. Yongdan was returning, chanting a Tibetan liturgy. If he came alone and singing, it was a sudden hope, nay, a certainty, which flashed across my mind. The young Lama was before me, a mocking smile on his lips. He opened his hand and showed me a silver coin. He has given me a rupee as alms, he said. Now let us be off quickly. Yongdan had learned that the Ponpo was stationed there specially to watch over the road and see that no traveler crossing the pass should escape investigation. We could congratulate ourselves on our good luck, but we were far from having finished with incidents of that kind. We had not long to wait before our nerves received a still greater shock. The very same morning, a little farther on our way, we again heard about a Ponpo from a soldier who came hurriedly downhill to attend to some relay business. This one was crossing the range which we had just begun to mount. The news terrified us. No escape was possible. The path lay along a steep slope that did not offer any hiding place. The coming official would see us both. No doubt he would question us. These Lhasa men, of whom a large number go to the English stations in the Himalayas and even to India, have many opportunities of seeing white people, and are much cleverer than the common folk of Eastern or Northern Tibet in detecting them. Anyhow, we could not escape the meeting. We spent a few hours of terrible mental agony, listening for a noise to warn us of the dreaded apparition, looking desperately to the right and to the left in the hope that, as in the old tales, a rock or a tree would open suddenly and shelter us till the danger was over. But, alas, no miracle happened. Fairies and gods left us apparently unaided. In the middle of the afternoon we suddenly heard the jingling of bells. Just above our heads, on the winding path, appeared a well-dressed, sturdy man followed by soldiers and servants leading horses. He stopped, astonished at the sight of us. According to Tibetan custom, we threw ourselves hurriedly on the low side of the road, to show our respect. The official proceeded downward and stopped again before us, surrounded by his followers. Now began the questions about our mother country, about our journey and other things. When all had been said, the Ponpo still remained looking silently at us, as did all who were behind him. I felt as if needles were piercing my brain, so awful was the tension of my nerves. Did these men doubt us? That silence must be broken or something bad would come of it. What could I do? Yes, I knew. With the chanting tone of the Tibetan beggars, only a little moderated by reverence, I implored a charity. My voice broke the concentration of the group. Even physically I felt the relaxation. the Tibetans had lost their suspicious manner. Some laughed. The good official took a coin from his purse and handed it to my companion. "Mother!" exclaimed Yonglin, simulating a most happy surprise, "look what the Ponpo gives us." I manifested my joy in a way befitting my assumed personality, with a wish, a very sincere, and coming from the bottom of my heart, for the prosperity and long life of my benefactor. The latter smiled at me and I answered the favor of his smile with the most respectful of Tibetan salutes. I put out my tongue as far as I could extend it. "Jetsma," means reverend lady, said Yonglin, a few minutes later, "you spake truth indeed when you told me, in the forests of Kakapo, that you would make them dream and see visions slash no doubt that fat fellow and his retainers, who looked so long at you, have been bewitched." Standing at the top of the pass, we shouted, loudly and heartily, "Lajalo! Datamkfam!" means, "the gods win, the demons are defeated." But I did not allude to the two kind Ponpos in mentioning demons, quite the contrary. May happiness befall them till the last of their earthly days, and thereafter. Chapter 3. The joy which our double victory had left us was not devoid of nervousness. We were now on the alert and expected to confront a Ponpo at each turning of the path. On our way down, the jingling of a bell that we heard coming in our direction gave us a terrible fright. The bell, however, was attached to the neck of a goat, which soon appeared, carrying some baggage belonging to an aged couple going on a pilgrimage to the Kakapo. The husband was a lean, tall camper with bright eyes in a bold wrinkled face suitable to a retired robber chieftain, and the wife's slightly stooping figure still allowed one to guess what an energetic matron she had been. Together, with the goat bearing its queer head haughtily as if in utter disgust of the masters who had enslaved her frail body but had not tamed her wild little mind, they formed a most picturesque group. The vivacious animal took the opportunity of our arrival to turn its back and run away. The old Pekpel tried to run after it, but they were not a match for that little demon, which trotted a few steps, then stopped and looked at them mockingly, and then started off again. It looked really intelligent and worthy of a better lot than that of a beast of burden. Yonglin succeeded in catching it and leading it upward again. The pilgrim pair thanked him profusely. Beholding the goat which now waited patiently for them, the lama addressed the two villagers seriously. "Be careful," he said, "to be very kind to that beast. It has been related to you in a previous life when it was a human being. On account of some bad deeds it has been reborn in the sorrowful animal kingdom. On account, also, of previous good actions, it has now got the happy chance of journeying to the holy Kakapo. Owing to the merit of that pilgrimage, it will be once more a man in its next life, and you three will meet again, so do your best in order that feelings of friendship may be cultivated between you which will bear good fruits in the future." The red hat of my companion, perhaps also the dark forest that surrounded us and the first shadow of the evening that spread all around, imparted a peculiar solemnity to that astonishing oracular pronouncement. The old peasants looked deeply impressed and expressed their gratitude to the Seer Lama who had revealed to them such an important mystery. Before we started I saw the woman taking a few packages out of the goat's load to lighten it, while the old man baited it. "The little thing will be happy now," Yongden told me, as we continued to walk down the hill. "They will treat it kindly and allow it to die a natural death." Why did I invent that story? Really, I could not tell, it came by itself. "Could it not be," I suggested, "that you yourself in a previous life were related to the goat?" My prophet friend stopped, gazing at me, trying to guess if I was joking or speaking seriously. He did not appear to appreciate that relationship much, even in a remote past. I laughed. Well, said Yonglin, "after all, a good beast deserves much more esteem than many men who are but scoundrels. Let me be the Aku of the goat, if you like. I do not mind. It was a nice little thing." The incidents of the day had put a great strain on our nerves, and in spite of the little fun we had just enjoyed we felt really tired and not in a mood either to walk the whole night or to stay amongst talkative people in a village, even if we could have reached one, which was rather doubtful. Our road lay on the side of the range, which remained most of the time in the shade, so that the streams were scalloped with ice and the ground deeply frozen. That circumstance did not promise an agreeable camping. Nevertheless, we decided to stay in a melancholy valley which crossed our path. Most luckily, wood was lying on the ground in large quantities, but even before a big fire we remained shivering, and the desolate landscape seemed to add to the sensation of icy cold which pervaded us. To sleep unsheltered in such a spot seemed decidedly miserable. I thought that, although in pitching the tent we lost the benefit of our blanket, we should be more comfortable with a roof over our heads. We therefore filled two rubber bottles with boiling water and slept with them under our dresses, in the well-closed tent, whose thin cloth, however, was a very feeble barrier against the cold. We did not reach the village situated at the foot of the Kulan until the middle of the afternoon. Yongdan visited a few houses to purchase food, and the good people pressed him to stay overnight because, they said, it was too late to cross the pass that day. We knew it, but we had traveled so slowly during the last week that we wished to push a little ahead. Moreover, I had not yet slept amongst Tibetans since leaving Yunnan, and I deemed it prudent to delay until we should be farther in the interior of Tibet before venturing on intimate contact with the people of the country, thus giving them the opportunity of observing us at close quarters. So Yongdan, taking advantage of the fact that I had continued to walk while he was busy making his purchases, pointed me out, already high on the winding path, and declared that we should have thankfully accepted their kind hospitality had we been together, but that he could not now call his old mother back. We cooked some soup for our supper by the roadside, and crossed the pass at about midnight. It was covered with forests, and a grassy slope free of trees rose from the path itself. Perhaps in daytime one could get a view of the surrounding country from its summit, but it was of course impossible to ascertain it at night. The climbing had warmed us, and tired us as well, so that I felt tempted to pitch our tent among the evergreens that grew in clusters on the small flat piece of ground forming the top of the pass. We were neither thirsty nor hungry, and could have waited to drink tea until we had found water lower down on the next day. But Yongdan objected that a traveler never spent the night on the summit of a pass, and that we should be frozen to death if we were foolish enough to stop and sleep. It was nonsense. We should obviously have been cold, after the heat produced by our walk had cooled down, but there was no fear of freezing. Be that as it may, it is difficult, even for one who has had a partly foreign education from childhood, to give up entirely the ancestral notions of his native land. True Tibetans never spend the night on the top of the pass, and the height of their mountains sufficiently explains that custom, but I suppose that even in the middle of the summer, and in a warmer country, most of them would still strongly hesitate to depart from their time-honored rule. As my companion appeared so reluctant to halt, I did not want to press him. We continued on our way. About an hour later we reached a partly level, wide ground sheltered by huge trees but free from undergrowth. In the night it appeared extraordinarily majestic. A mountain stream roared nearby against a wall of whitish rocks and added greatly to the impression caused by the sight itself. This was an ideal camping place and we were not the only ones to appreciate it as such, for, after having wandered about a little, Yongdan and I discovered several primitive hearths marking the spots where travelers were in the habit of stopping to make tea. Near one of them we slept without pitching our tent. We had heard about brigands rambling between the two passes, waiting for travelers, and did not want to attract their attention. Still, we lighted a small fire to boil some tea. I had seldom had a more sumptuous bedroom than that natural and immense hall whose tall pillars supported a roof of thick foliage. It reminded me of the temple-like glade where I had halted one night while rounding the Kakapo. But this place was much larger and less gloomy. The next day, I enjoyed a lazy morning to compensate for a nocturnal tramp. We were eating a flour broth which my naturally excellent appetite, much increased by the pure air and long daily walks, made me find delicious, when a man appeared. He was one of the villagers who had accompanied the baggage of the Ponpo whom we met on the road, and had witnessed the generosity of the gentleman. To such a man we could not be suspect, and moreover the smell of the broth kept warm on the embers was an attraction sufficient in itself. He came straight to us, sat himself near the fire, and a talk followed our invitation to take his bowl out of his amphaga and to share our meal. This is never refused by Tibetans, who are capable of eating any amount at any time. As was to be expected, Yongdan had to cast lots and the man went away, after having invited us to his house in the next village, called Jitong. We again crossed a minor pass during the morning. Thence a steady descent on a good path led us to a cultivated area. On reaching it, we met a large party of pilgrims, who certainly numbered more than 100, mostly lay people, men and women. Some of them stopped my companion for the inevitable business of casting lots. This time, however, the monotony of that work was relieved by the subject proposed to the science of the seer by one of the inquirers. This man had brought with him from his home a small ass which carried his luggage. The object of the mower was to know if it was good, or not, to let the animal go round the kakapa with his owner. If it were foreseen that the journey would turn out badly, the beast would be left at Pido Gompa and the Adlija would take it home on his way back at the end of his pilgrimage. The little long-eared fellow was not to be consulted, but its good luck had led it to a compassionate friend. Yongdan afterward told me that he picture four vertical bar out to himself all the steep climbing that would be hard on the tiny feet of the poor donkey, the high passes, now covered with deep snow, the frosty nights to be passed in the open, and all the other troubles which would befall the little slave. How much happier it would be to get a month's rest in the pleasant grazing grounds of the Pido Valley. So, after appropriate gestures and recitations, the oracle declared that without the least doubt the beast would die if it only came in sight of the kakapo, and that such a death happening during a pilgrimage would greatly diminish the merits and blessed results which each pilgrim expected from his pious journey. That community of interests was created to ensure that not only the master of the animal, but all his companions would look carefully to it that the latter be left behind at Pido. Yongdan was profusely thanked for his remarkable and most valuable advice, and a few presents entered our provision bags in gratitude. While the young man was delivering his oracle, a well-dressed lama came into sight, accompanied by a few retainers, all riding beautiful horses. As he proceeded, I noticed that he was looking at my son. Perhaps he too harbored in his mind some disquieting thoughts and would like to learn the future from the red cap nonchia whose heir, I must admit, announced a high degree of proficiency. But his rank did not allow him to humble his fine traveling robe of brugte yellow brocade by alighting on the dusty road. Perhaps he sighed when the ragged seer, who had by then finished lecturing his pilgrims, passed near him without asking his blessing or showing any special mark of respect. Twice he looked backward at him, but seeing me and being probably ashamed to be caught paying attention to a mere Rajopa, he quickly turned his head, and I saw only his shining yellow back and his large gilded travelling hat of wood which was almost the same shape as the roof of the monastery of which he was the lord. As it was still early, we did not wish to halt, and preferred to dispense with the invitation we had received. So, instead of looking for the house of our would-be host, we endeavoured to cross the village speedily. We had nearly reached the end of the inhabited zone when, passing by a farm, a door opened in the enclosure of a courtyard, and, lo, the man whom we had already met several times appeared as if out of the wall, like a hobgoblin. I suppose that he must have been waiting for us. Yongdan tried vainly to parley with him, but the farmer would not listen. Why did we wish to proceed, since we were certain not to reach the next village before night? The astonished villager put the question to us and we did not know what answer to give him, for authentic Ajapas sleep in the jungle only when they cannot possibly avoid it. As a rule they halt near some building, and when happy enough to be called inside they never think of refusing the good luck. I was very much annoyed, but feared to seem strange in preferring the jungle to the hospitality of a farm of comfortable appearance. We therefore stepped in, uttering thanks and blessings, and were shown to the top story, where lived the family, the ground floor being, as usual, occupied by stables. This was the first time I had been the guest of Tibetans in my role of a beggar. A Tibetan house had nothing new for me, but my present disguise made things very different from what they had been in the course of my previous journeys. Although on those I did not indulge in Western customs, the servants who followed me, my fine beasts, and my good lamaist attire kept my hosts respectful and distant. Enjoyed all the privileges of quietness and privacy, or as much privacy as there is in the East. And the life of a lama of rank is far from being unpleasant. On the contrary, I could not now expect much attention, but only, at the best, the condescending kindness of these coarse and common folk who would include me in Yongdan's train. His dress is a member of the religious order commanding a certain respect. I was to experience various things which until then I had only observed from afar. I should be sitting on the rough floor of the kitchen, which was dirty with the grease of the soup, the butter of the tea, and the spit of the inmates. Well-meaning women would offer me a scrap of a piece of meat they had cut on the lap of their dress which had been used, maybe for years, as a handkerchief and a kitchen towel. I should have to eat in the way of the poor, dipping my unwashed fingers in the soup and in the tea, to knead at sampa, and to do any number of things which disgusted me. Yet I knew that such penance would not be without reward, and that under cover of my inconspicuous garb of a poor pilgrim I should gather a quantity of observations which would never have come within reach of a foreigner, or even, perhaps, of a Tibetan of the upper classes. I was to live near the very soul and heart of the masses of that unknown land, near those of its women folk whom no outsider had ever approached. To the knowledge I had already acquired about the religious people of the country I would add another and quite intimate one, concerning its humblest sons and daughters. For this it was certainly worthwhile overlooking my disgust and making the even more difficult sacrifice of delightful hours of solitude in the enchanting jungle. The man who received us was a rather wealthy villager. Nevertheless, he allowed us to cook our own food, a broth of which he took his share, thinking, perhaps, that it was his due for having supplied a few turnips which he cut without peeling or washing and threw in the pot. In any other country, the sand would have been noticeable in the soup, but I cannot say often enough that Tibet is a land of wonder which changes everything for the best. At least it has always been so for me. The broth was delicious, some neighbors called in the evening. They were all informed by our host of the two Lhasa officials' generosity toward us, and Yongdan declared boldly that these good gentlemen of Owen Tsang were religious-minded and that he was accustomed to receive such bounties. I profited by the opportunity to inquire about places where we could expect to meet other officials. I said that we had exhausted our money and we would want to beg from them food or silver on our way back home. I had invented that story so as to inform myself as minutely as possible about the Ponpasa residences. The peasants would think my eagerness to know the smallest details of the situation of the Zongza was due to the necessity of securing food. People who sought with such earnestness to meet officials could not but appear honest and respectable travelers who had nothing to fear from the authorities. Had the Tibetans whom I met during my journey conceived the least doubt about my origin, such inquiry, and the reason given for it, would have immediately dispelled their suspicion. That evening I heard that the military rolls were filled in the new valley in the very same way as in the north of Kham. A number of villagers were enlisted who could remain at home and continue their ordinary work, but had to join the troops as soon as they were ordered. As wages they enjoyed several advantages, exemption of taxes or of statute labor and sometimes a small salary paid generally in kind. A thing which had surprised me very much, 2 years before, in Kham, had been to hear the reports about the uncommonly large number of soldiers stationed at the New Thibet-Chinese border. One spoke of 300 men in such a monastery, 300 in such another, 300 again in a third, and so on. The repetition of that number 300 first attracted my attention. I was accustomed to find such repetitions in the sacred scriptures of the Orient. It was a question, in some books, of 500 followers, 500 chariots, 500 sheep, 500 no matter what. One had to understand that the conventional expression in reality meant merely an indefinitely large number, In later literature, the modest 500 grew to be 5,000, 8,000, till they reached the 80,000 of the Mahayanist Buddhist treatises, to which the good Tibetan translators have still added a few thousands and hundreds of their own.